The Gospel of John. How does it end? Well, it could have ended with chapter 19 and verse 30. So when Jesus had received the sour wine, he said, "It is finished." And bowing his head, he gave up his spirit. Jesus dies. So we all go home. Is that the end? If it is, then all these details about Jesus' burial are unnecessary. Why do we know that Joseph of Arimathea took down the body? Why do we need to hear about how he and Nicodemus, verse 40, bound it in strips of linen with the spices, as the custom of the Jews is to bury? Why do we need to know that Jesus was buried in a new tomb, which Matthew tells us was hewn out of the rock? Why? Why all these details? Because although it is finished, it is not the end. Chapter 20, verse 1, "Now on the first day of the week," that's the Sunday, "Mary Magdalene went to the tomb early." So on this Sunday morning, we too shall visit the tomb. So please come with me to John's Gospel, chapter 20, and the first 10 verses. Please have them open in front of you. And together what we'll do is we'll follow the narrative, and then we'll see. So what's the story? Verse 1, on Sunday morning, before first light, Mary Magdalene sets off for the tomb. What do we know of Mary? Well, Luke tells us that out of Mary had come seven demons. Think about that. She was living a nightmare existence until she met Jesus. And then with that word of authority, that voice of command, he literally banished her demons. But she didn't get her old life back. On the contrary, Christ gave her a new life. And her heart, once occupied by Satan, now overflows with love for Jesus. So is it any surprise that we find her standing at the cross? John says, 19 verse 25, "Now there stood by the cross of Jesus his mother and his mother's sister, Mary the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene." In fact, she's not just standing by the cross, she's also the last to leave. Matthew, in the parallel account, we read, "When Joseph had taken the body, he wrapped it in a clean linen cloth, and laid it in his new tomb, which had been hewn out of the rock. And he rolled a large stone against the door of the tomb and departed. And Mary Magdalene was there, sitting opposite the tomb." Mary watches as that great stone is rolled across the mouth of the tomb, sealing in the body of Jesus. And if Mary is the last to leave on the Friday, here she's the first to return on the Sunday. What does that tell you? The last to leave, the first to arrive. Who has possession of her heart? Where is her treasure? What does it tell you? It tells you that Jesus has her heart. And how is her devotion expressed? By doing what she can. As far as she's concerned, all that remains of Jesus is his body, which is up before the crack of dawn, hurrying to the tomb to anoint and embalm her beloved Lord. She can't rest. She can't sit still until she's done what she can do for him, even when facing apparently impossible obstacles. After all, who's going to move that great stone? Now, why does Mary love Jesus as she does? Well, it's obvious, isn't it? It's because of what he has done for her. Freely forgiven, she freely loves. Having been a slave to Satan, she now gives her heart to Jesus. And her devotion knows no limits. He has her heart. Christian friends, what of you? She's the last to leave and the first to arrive. Am I the last to leave? I'm the first to arrive. You can take it literally, can't you? But you know exactly what I mean. Am I the last to leave and the first to arrive when it comes to Jesus? Do I linger around Christ, waiting, watching, looking, longing, just to be near him, just to meet with him, just to do something for him, anything? What is the measure of my devotion? How great is the debt that I feel I owe? The answer that you give will be seen in the life that you live. So then Mary comes to the tomb. But she's not alone. She's accompanied, we're told in the other Gospels, by other women. After all, she uses the word we in verse 2. And she discovers, verse 1, that the stone has been rolled away. Now think of it. This great circular stone rolls down a sloping groove across the door, sealing the body in. So easy to close, isn't it? Because it's all downhill. But it's so hard to open. But the stone has been rolled back. By who? What does it mean? And the guards have gone. And then look inside. The tomb is empty. And in Mary's mind, there can be only one explanation. Verse 2, then she ran and came to Simon Peter and the other disciple whom Jesus loved and said to them, they have taken away the Lord out of the tomb and we do not know where they have laid him. So while the other women linger at the tomb, Mary feels she's got to do something. And so she runs to the two senior disciples, Peter and John. Can you hear the distress in her voice? Can you hear the panic? She's been to the tomb. The tomb is empty. The grave's been plundered. This is the worst of all worlds. This is another blow. Even after he's dead, they still can't leave him alone. They've taken away the Lord out of the tomb. This is a voice of distress, isn't it? And we do not know where they have laid him. So verse 3, Peter takes the lead, followed by John. Peter therefore went out, and the other disciple, and were going to the tomb, so they both ran together. Peter and John running side by side. But soon, verse 4, John outruns Peter. And he arrives at the tomb first. Anyone here ever do cross country at school? No. The hands got off over here. Those cold winter mornings and red thighs and wheezing lungs. And we had a teacher who trained with the Chindits. He was ex-army. Who, when your will was failing, would suddenly leap out from behind a hedge and say, run, 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 run. But if you started across country side by side, it wouldn't be long, would it, before you were strung out in a long line and the front runners would be out of sight. Well, that's what's going on here, isn't it? They set off side by side, but soon John outruns Peter. He's the faster man. Is it because Peter's older? Is it because Peter is of a heavier build? Shane Williams against Ewan Murray? Or do Peter's legs fail him because he's carrying a burden that John is not? A troubled conscience. Well, John arrives first, verse 5, and he, stooping down and looking in, saw the linen cloths lying there, yet he did not go in. But John arrives first, he stoops down, he looks in. Why doesn't he go inside? Why does John linger on the threshold? It's because of what he sees. If the tomb had been empty, John may well have gone in, but he sees something that stops him in his tracks. He sees what he doesn't expect to see. What? Verse 5, and he, stooping down and looking in, saw the linen cloths lying there. And the word lying is used three times in verses 5 to 7. Here is something of great significance. Now, if Jesus' body had been stolen, as Mary thought, would you expect to see the grave clothes? Well, no. If you're taking a dead body, you don't go to all the time and care to unwrap the body first, do you? I mean, it's daft, it's ridiculous, it's illogical. But it's not just that the grave clothes have been left behind, it's how they're left behind. We're told, chapter 19, verse 40, then they took the body of Jesus and bound it in strips of linen with the spices, as the custom of the Jews is to bury. So Jesus' body is wound in a burial shroud, woven into the folds of which are these spices. Now the burial shroud is still there, but it's not been unwrapped, it's not been unwound. It's just that the body that was inside it has gone. Can you make sense of that? It's like an empty cocoon that's collapsed under the weight of the spices. There's no sign of disorder. There's no evidence of it being unwound. The strips of cloth haven't been torn off and thrown on the floor. There's no sign even that it's been touched. Only that the body inside it is gone. The chrysalis is empty. And the butterfly has flown. Do you remember when Lazarus rose from the dead? What do they have to do? Jesus says, loose him from the grave clothes. Well, here is a different order altogether. It's as though Jesus' body has passed through the shroud without disturbing it. And John looks and thinks and wonders. Verse 6, then Simon Peter came, following him, and went into the tomb. And we feel that's our Peter, don't we? No hesitation, straight in. And there he saw the linen cloths lying there. And because now he's inside the low cave of the tomb, Peter now sees something that John hasn't seen. Verse 7. He saw the linen cloths lying there and the handkerchief that had been around his head. Not lying with the other linen cloths, well, not lying with the linen cloths, but folded together in a place by itself. It's another extraordinary thing. Slightly separate from the main burial shroud is another cloth. It's the one which had been wrapped around Jesus' head at his burial, rather like a turban. Now, has it, as it were, been unwound and folded rather neatly? You know, like ironing handkerchiefs and sort of put in a sort of separate place. You could read it like that, couldn't you? But that's not the sense of the words in the original. What it's saying is that this cloth is standing up by itself. The folds still retain the shape of Jesus' head. Only there's no head inside it. Do you see? Everything is just as Joseph and Nicodemus have left it. I mean, the body is gone. There's no sign of any disturbance or violence or robbery. It is altogether of a different order. So what does it mean? Verse 8. Then the other disciple who came to the tomb first went in also, and he saw and believed. John steps in. He's been thinking, looking, lingering, wondering. And now as he sees, he understands. The undisturbed linen cloths. The body gone. Do the arithmetic. There can only be one explanation. Jesus is risen. Verse 9, for as yet they did not know the scripture that he must rise again from the dead. That morning, John didn't run to the tomb expecting it to be empty. You know, today's the third day and I've got my Scriptures all worked out. The third day, we know the scriptures. Of course, we know what to expect. The third day, he's going to rise from the dead. That was the last thing on his mind. This is also unexpected, because he and Peter had never understood those scriptures which spoke of Jesus' resurrection. And now as John looks, as he sees, the light is beginning to dawn. And he believes. And no doubt all those scriptures will begin to crowd his mind. The empty tomb. The empty shroud. Only one explanation is possible. Jesus Christ is risen. And soon Mary will hear Jesus call her name. And by the end of the day, Jesus himself will meet with his disciples in that locked room. One of them will be absent. Thomas, the skeptic. Thomas, who's not into delusional fantasies. Who says, I'm not going to believe. Verse 25, I'm not going to believe unless I see in his hands the print of the nails and put my finger into the print of the nails and put my hand into his side. I will not believe. And by the next Sunday, Thomas receives the proof he demands. And we come to the climax of that resurrection account as Thomas worships the risen Lord. And he cries aloud, my Lord and my God. And within days, this terrified group of broken disciples, they haven't packed up and gone home. Jesus is dead. That's the end of the story. We're finished there. Nor have they appointed themselves a new leader. On the contrary, these men, now with lion-hearted courage, they fill Jerusalem and the world beyond with the wonderful news that Jesus Christ is risen. Many of them sealing that testimony with their own blood. Well, if Thomas' confession, my Lord and my God, if that is the noonday, then the dawn arrives with the empty tomb and the empty shroud. Christian friends, this passage calls for reflection. I find myself lingering with John on the threshold. I don't want to speak. I just want to look. And then as Peter arrives, I step inside with him. And I look around, and I take it all in. And then I'm back with John outside, and I step inside again. Not what I expected to see. I need to gaze. I need to unravel the riddle. To see and believe. This is not, as it were, the resurrection story, and then we leave it, like all stories, flat upon the page. It's all so vivid, isn't it? So real, so human. We've all met Marys in a panic. John's sprint. John's wonder. Peter arriving, just stepping in as Peter would always do. Because these are eyewitness accounts. These are real people, flesh and blood, like you and me. They were there. And I want to see it with their eyes. And I want to take this first stepping stone, and the next, and the next, and the next, until with Thomas I'm left in adoring wonder, crying, my Lord and my God. So what should we learn this morning? Well, let me speak to the Christians first. Christian friends, do your sins rise up and condemn you? You turn the corner, and there's guilt. He's after you again. He's got a big stick in his hand. And he smashes it down upon your head. As you lie there groaning, it goes through all your pockets and robs you of your assurance. And you'd be mugged by guilt. Is that you? Then you must stand at the cross And you must hear that cry with a loud voice. It is finished. But you must linger at the tomb. Because how do I know it is finished? How do I know the ransom is paid? What assurance do I have that the debt has been paid and therefore I, the debtor, am free? Well, as Paul says, he was delivered up because of our offenses and was raised up because of our justification. Do you see? If he is risen, it can only mean one thing. He's paid in full the price that my sins demand. And there is therefore nothing more to pay. If he's still in that tomb, if he's still dead, then he hasn't paid for my sins. There's still a debt that to be owed. But the very fact he is risen, he's done all that is necessary. Nothing more needs to be done. God is satisfied. That's God's answer. That's God's reply. I'm satisfied with the death of my son. It really is finished. Nothing more to pay. My debt is paid, and I, the debtor, can walk free. The girl of 12 was dying of cancer. She was a believer. Her parents said to her, "Trust in the love of God." She said, "No." She said, "I'm trusting in the justice of God. But Jesus has been punished once for my sins. Justice has been done. Therefore, God will not punish those sins a second time." Christian friends, the resurrection is God's declaration that justice has been done. My sins have been punished. Punished once. God will not require, therefore, of me a punishment a second time. And although I am a guilty sinner, I can walk free. God requires nothing more. Christian friend, do you ever wonder if it's all true? You know, maybe people are right, aren't they, when they laugh and they say, "Well, you're not living in the real world." Or when I was speaking to someone on the phone, and he was laughing and he was mocking and he was saying, "Oh, yeah, of course you've had some psychological experience. You've had some religious experience, and that's very nice for you. We all have psychological experiences." Maybe he was right. Maybe it's just a psychological experience I've had. Or when they say, you know, Christianity is for losers. Look what you're losing out on. Can I really believe the gospel? Well, come. Linger at the threshold. And look. Enter the tomb. And look, it's a real shroud lying upon hewn rock. It's real. It's a fact. He is not here. He's risen. At the heart of the gospel is a fact. A well-attested fact. A wonderfully attested fact. That Jesus Christ is risen. Which is why my future is not just some disembodied spirit floating around in the clouds. Because he is risen bodily, I too will rise bodily. To be a new body, a glorious body, immortal, prepared for the new heavens and the new earth. And that is living in the real world. And Christian friends, what are you going to do when you come to die? God may not give you time to prepare in that way, but maybe he will. Maybe in his kindness he'll give you days, weeks, months to prepare for your coming death. As I lie on my deathbed, I want to run with Peter and John. I'm going to outrun Peter. I'm going to get there first. And I'm going to stop and gaze with John. When Peter arrives,
or going with him? As I look, as I take it all in, I remember that God has raised him from the dead in the power of an endless life. And therefore, as the writer to the Hebrews says, therefore he is able to save to the uttermost. He is able to bring a full, complete, absolute, total salvation. He is able to save to the uttermost all who come to God through him, since he ever lives. The empty tomb, the light of the resurrection, will flood my dying hours and bring me unspeakable joy. And Christian friends, is your mind cloud with questions and issues and troubles? Yes, come on a Sunday morning and you're already thinking about Monday and the things you've got on Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday and that meeting on Thursday and all the things that go on through our minds. And our minds are crowded, aren't they? And our vision is clouded. What do I need? I need the quiet of the cemetery, don't I? I need the cool of the tomb. I need to look, to linger, to believe, to understand. And like Mary, to see that all I have ever been is a great sinner, but a sinner saved by Jesus. And so ultimately, all that really matters is to love and to adore and to offer again my life to him in wonder, in adoration, in worship, my Lord and my God. But we'll close with this. What if this morning you're not a believer? Rico Tice took a rugby ball, threw it to the people. Someone caught it and threw it back. Took the rugby ball, did it again, and the ball returned. He then put the ball down. He tossed out an imaginary rugby ball, which somebody caught and threw back. He threw out the imaginary rugby ball a few more times. And each time the imaginary rugby ball came back. But then he said, not very exciting, is it? Not very interesting. Rugby without the ball. And then he said, that's what life is like without Jesus. We've missed the whole point. Rugby without the ball. We've missed the whole point. And this morning, if you do not know Jesus Christ, you're missing the whole point. Maybe sometimes in your sober moments, you actually feel that. I'm missing something. Are you spiritual? Islam? Hinduism? Buddhism? But all their founders are dead. It's rugby without the ball. Only Jesus lives. Are you a disciple of Darwin? There is no God. There's no need for a God. But can a dead man sort out your life? Can Darwin give you a new life? Can he deal with your guilt and your shame? And what happens when you come to die? Can Darwin rescue you from hell? I'd want to be in the hands of one who has conquered death. Wouldn't you? And are you big on relationships? Marriage, children, family. That's the big thing. Relationships. I was reading a poem of a friend written after her husband of 40 years had died. It was a poem about time, about the passing of the seasons. And the final line said this, Time has no meaning. He is not here. She couldn't move on. There was nowhere to go. He is not here. That's how all relationships end, ultimately, isn't it? Even the closest, sweetest, most wonderful, vibrant relationships, till death us do part. He is not here. But Christians never say that. They can never say he's not here. They say he is here. He's risen. And he's mine. And I am his forever. My friend, do your gods live? Will they forsake you in the end? Can your God save you from your sins? Can they give you a new life? Can they give you a real reason to live? Can they prepare you for death? And can they bring you safely to heaven? Are you playing rugby without the ball? And every day you're pretending, catching, throwing your back. But it's a pretense. My friend, Jesus died the punishing death that sinners like you and me deserve to die. And now he lives to save all who come to him. Cling to your gods and you will perish with them. But come to Jesus Christ and he will give to you everlasting life. He is risen. That's why this morning he is here. And that's why this morning he stands in the preaching with arms open wide, inviting you to come to him. He is here, ready to save all who call upon him.